And thank you, everybody, for signing up. I'm now going to set everybody on mute by default, but you can always unmute for questions. And we're good to go. Again, I just put the link into the link for the source sheet into the chat. In order to actually get the source sheet, you have to click on the link and then download it. Otherwise, it's just going to show you the first page, which is useful for a little while, but not fully. Welcome to a three-part series. The series in general is Clashes in Jewish Publishing. And what I want to do through the course of this series is to learn about certain key events in Jewish history that are all publishing-related, to understand the importance of publishing and the role it played in the development of Judaism and the Jewish people. I'm wondering, I didn't compare the lists. I gave this series, basically, earlier version of it, in January of 2015 at Beth Emeth. I figured it was safe to revisit, first of all, because in the last 5 years, a lot of people have started coming to the classes, and because January classes in person don't get a large crowd. So I figured we can get the people who were snowbirds at that point. But if anybody here was in the January 2015 series and wants to correct me on anything, that's fine. Tell me whether this version is better. The goals that I have for today's session, which is probably as a topic going to extend into week two a little bit, the censorship topic, is to understand a key element in the historic Jewish-Christian relationship and how it impacted the development of Jewish studies itself, of Jewish studies and Judaism itself. So I want to start with a question. The Index Librorum Prohibitorum, the roster of banned books held by the Catholic Church, was first published by the Catholic Church under Pope Paul IV in the year 1559. When was that index officially decommissioned? When did they stop using the index? No fair Googling. You can't look it up online. That's not allowed.
1960s.
Ooh, Professor Sakin. Yes, he is correct. The 1960s was when they ended the use of the index. And we're going to talk about why they stopped in the 60s. But it's not because of the liberalization of the church. That was not the reason for it. So we have a lot to talk about, a lot that precedes 1559 before we can even get to the point where they're publishing an index. Let's start from the beginning. The church's instincts were always restrictive in terms of dealing with ideas that they didn't agree with. And that's not really surprising, because the two major philosophical influences on the church were themselves restrictive. What were the two major influences on the development of the philosophy of the Catholic Church? Where did their ideas largely come from? Susan, you're muted.
Wasn't it the Bible?
So, you say the Bible. I mean, Judaism.
The New Testament?
Not the New Testament.
The Old Testament to start with.
All their ideas, certainly the ones that I like, tend to be Jewish in origin. They changed certain ideas. Well, they changed pretty much everything to fit what they wanted, but their ideas largely have roots that are Jewish. And what's the other one? Somebody sent it to me in the chat, but they sent it privately, so nobody else saw it. The Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, Greek thought also was a major influence on the early church. And both Judaism and the thought of the Greeks were restrictive in nature, were censoring cultures. If you take a look at source number one on the source sheet, and again, I put the link in the chat, I'm going to do it one more time now because people have joined since I put that in before. But take a look at this passage, a verse from the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. And you shall remember all the mitzvot of God, and you shall practice them, and you shall not stray after your hearts and after your eyes, after which you stray. V'lo sasuru achrei levavchem v'achrei einechem. In the Hebrew, you shall not stray after your hearts and after your eyes. And that is understood in the Talmud to be a warning. Don't stray after your eyes is specifically about sexual immorality. And don't stray after your hearts means don't stray after that which is heretical. So if you take a look at source number 2, you find how the sages of the Mishnah view this and the lesson they take from it. So you're talking about a text that's now more than 2,000 years old that says one who looks at four things would have been better off not having entered the world. There are four things you shouldn't investigate. What is above the world, below the world, before the world, and after it. If one does not respect his Creator's honor, it would have been appropriate had he not entered the world. Now, what that is talking about, and how Judaism played out in terms of censorship, is a fascinating discussion in its own right. What was it that we said not to investigate? Why were we not to investigate it? Those are good questions that are worthy of their own series. It's not simple and straightforward. This is not a statement of Jews should not go into outer space, or that we shouldn't study physics. That's not what this is. But that's another time. I'm bringing it for you right now just to show that Judaism, from which you get so much of Christianity, is fundamentally in favor of the idea of self-censorship. Even though Judaism taught that Torah was true, there was a concern that people don't always act logically. People don't always follow their intellect. And you can read something or hear something, and it can influence you, not because it's correct, but because the speaker is attractive, because it comes from the majority of the population, because something is presented in a certain attractive way. So therefore, Judaism said, certain things should just be avoided. That was from a Jewish perspective. A lot of people already know that about Judaism. However, what people may not be aware of is that the Greeks were censoring as well. I mean, Socrates was executed, right, in 399 before the Common Era for being a corrupting influence. But Plato was somebody who certainly was a believer in censorship because he believed human beings are easily misled. When you think of Plato's ideal form of government, right, the republic, who is it who guides the republic? Who's supposed to be the one who guides Plato's republic?
Philosophers.
Philosophers, right. It's not what we think of as democracy. Everybody gets a vote. It doesn't work that way. The idea for Plato is that the republic is governed by the elites. Not only that, Plato wanted to ban most of poetry in his ideal republic. Take a look at your sheet. It's source number 3. He says, poetry feeds and waters the passions and desires. She lets them rule instead of ruling them. And therefore, when we hear the encomiasts of Homer affirming that he is the educator of Hellas and that all life should be regulated by his precepts...
You're
not hearing me? Yeah, from time to time you get these problems. Hang on one second. That should make it better. Can you hear me better now, Susan? Okay.
Yes.
So, when we hear the encomiasts of Homer affirming that he is the educator of Hellas and that all life should be regulated by his precepts, we may allow the excellence of their intentions. People mean well when they praise Homer, and agree with them in thinking Homer a great poet and tragedian. But we shall continue to prohibit all poetry which goes beyond hymns to the gods and praises of famous men. Not pleasure and pain, but law and reason shall rule in our state. So Plato is also a fan of censorship. So that what you get is a church which is informed by two schools of thought which believe that foreign ideas can win if given free rein, not because they're correct, but because they are presented attractively, but they play on people's emotions and so on. And the church learns from that. But their censorship ebbs and flows inconsistently, because it becomes not so much a matter of philosophy as holding on to power against threats. It's less about philosophical debate, even when it is clothed in the language of philosophy, heresy, and so on. When there are perceived threats to power, that's when church censorship grows. And we'll see that very clearly as we look at the history. Tell me something. Anybody know who the first group censored by the church was? It wasn't us. It wasn't us. It wasn't the Jews. The first formal restriction...
The Beatles.
I'm sorry?
The Beatles.
So, no, Moish, not the Beatles. The pagans.
The
pagans. So actually, it seems like it were church sects, groups within the church who believed things that the church itself did not promote. Take a look on your sheet at source number 4 from George Haven Putnam, The Censorship of the Church of Rome, Volume 1. He traces your first formal church legislation to ban or to censor a work to about the year 150. A synod of bishops of Asia Minor meeting either at Ephesus or at Smyrna prohibits the Acta Pauli. What was the Acta Pauli? The Acta Pauli was an historical romance written about the middle of the second century and having for its purpose the glorification of the life and labors of St. Paul. Sounds like something they should like. The work was condemned on the ground that although apparently the work of a, quote, Orthodox Christian, it did not present an authentic record. What it presented was not the record of his life, it was fictionalized, and therefore they censored it. You see, further, in the year 325, they censor the Thalia of Arius. Arius got into a great philosophical debate at the Council of Nicaea in 325. There was a debate about the Trinity and the roles of the Father and the Son, and he wrote this poem, Thalia, to defend his position. So the church, when they didn't agree with him, banned the book. And they burned it and prescribed capital punishment for anybody who would read it. Then in the year 399, I had another one here from Emperor Constantine in 325. In the year 399, they had a decree against the works of Bishop Origen. In the year 435, they ordered the burning of the Nestorian writings. There was a church leader named Nestorius who also lost a philosophical debate about the nature of Mary and about God being God, but God being a person at the same time. In the year 496, the church comes up with its first catalog of restricted books. And they're basically about heretical works, but again, heretical works within the church. Early church censorship is not focused on the Jews at all. And then it disappears. From the late 5th century into the 6th century, censorship by the church largely falls apart. What was the big event, late 5th century, that would have led to the church no longer banning books, burning books? What changed?
The downfall of Rome.
Good. Cerona says the fall of the Roman Empire. The fall of the Roman Empire ushers in what people like to term the Dark Ages. The hallmark of the Dark Ages, an indifference to learning. Philosophy wasn't all that interesting to people at that point in time. And that extends, really, until you get to the Renaissance. So the result of that is that the church has no real reason to censor. You do have certain cases of destruction of books, but it tended to be more about destruction than about censorship. So in the 11th century, the end of the 11th century into the 12th century, the Crusaders marched through towns and they burned non-Christian books. But it's much more about harming the populations than it is about let's get rid of their books. It's not really about the books, it's about the property. That's the way it's generally looked at. You don't see a real revival of systematic censorship by the church until you get into, really, the 13th century. It starts in the 12th century. There was a man by the name of Peter the Venerable. I don't know if they called him venerable in his day. Maybe he only became venerable after that. I don't know. But he was an abbot from the Benedictine order. He was the abbot of Cluny. So Peter's approach was that he wanted to develop Christianity and spread it, studying the heresy of the heretics in the words of the heretics themselves so that he could defeat them. That was Peter's approach. So regarding Islam, he studied Islam not using whatever material there was floating around within the church, but reading Islamic works. He actually went to read it himself in order that he would be able to debate with Muslims. Now, he wasn't a reader of Arabic. He got it in translation. But that was Peter's move when it came to the Muslims. Regarding Judaism, he conducted Christianity's first examination of the Talmud. He's the first one in the church to look at the Talmud and to argue that the Talmud should be censored. He said the Talmud is irrational. Jewish teachings about God make God seem foolish. And he said that's why Jews don't accept Christianity. He says we've been failing to convert the Jews for 1,000 years and more. It's not because our arguments are no good. It's because the Jews are foolish. Because the Jews are not open to our logical arguments. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 6. Number 5 is just from a work about Peter and the Muslims. But take a look at source number 6. This is from a work called, as you can see, Framing Medieval Bodies. The first part of it is a quote from Peter about these Jews who refused to convert. He says, I really do not know whether a Jew is a man, given that he does not yield to human reason, nor does he assent to the divine authorities which are his own. He doesn't listen to his own God. Did the miracles of the Exodus happen so that you, Jew, could stuff your belly with a variety of foods, so that you could get drunk and snore in a drunken stupor? Did these things happen so that you could give such great rein to your desires and abandon yourselves to your lusts, so that you could abound so greatly in riches and fill chests with gold, silver, and many treasures, and so that you could elevate yourself with proud and dominating arrogance over inferiors? No. He is alleging that Jews have become decadent and have not done right by God, so to speak. God helped you in all of these ways, and you have been derelict in your responsibilities to God. You have deteriorated, and that's why you won't listen to our arguments on behalf of Christianity. And so the book goes on to say, it is clear to Peter that reason, which demarcates man from animal, simply does not operate in Jews. For in his eyes, Jews are only interested in worldly good. But the crucial question still remains. Why does reason not function in Jews? What is it that shuts down the working of reason in a Jew's mind? It is here that Peter introduces the Talmud. According to him, the fables of what to him is a hideous bestial book overshadows the hearts of Jews and obliterate Jewish capacity for reason. He says, it's because of what we are learning in our Talmud, that is what is leading us to ignore Christianity. And that move by Peter, examining the Talmud and condemning the Talmud as misrepresenting God and as leading Jews to not follow Christianity, is what triggers this new wave of Christian censorship starting in the 13th century. Now, there are a lot of reasons for why the 13th century sees this renewed attempt at censorship. Peter is certainly a factor, but he's not the only factor. In the 13th century, you see the revival of European learning beginning. Books start to matter. Therefore, the church becomes afraid of books. The church also develops a new approach at this point to trying to convert people, and Peter is very clearly informed by this. They, instead of saying, convert or die, right? Instead of saying, we are going to punish people if they don't convert, so your incentive for conversion is essentially survival, they said, we are going to argue them into converting. We're going to hold public debates in which we pit our Christian thinkers against Jewish thinkers, and we will get the Jews to admit that we won the debate and therefore they should convert to Christianity. They held something called, they held something called forced sermons. Right? That's where they lock the doors of the shul and say nobody gets to leave until... They held forced sermons in which Jews were compelled to attend church and to hear speeches that were specifically targeted to... I'm just getting a message in the chat. Okay. They were forced to attend speeches that were aimed at indoctrinating into Jews the value of Christianity. Interestingly, that actually has an impact on the development of Jewish thought. When I lived in Pennsylvania, there was a fellow in my community who taught in the Department of Religion at Muhlenberg College, a fellow by the name of Hartley Lachter. And he presented an idea which I thought was absolutely brilliant, which I think is relevant here. Those who study Jewish philosophy know that this period of time also sees a growth in Jewish mysticism, specifically published Jewish mysticism. Tremendous growth of it during this period specifically. And he argued that one of the factors behind that growth in published Jewish mysticism in this period, you're talking 13th century, 14th century, was a reaction to the church trying to argue Jews into accepting Christianity. In other words, since the church is arguing based on logic, trying to convince the Jews based on logic, we're going to escape that whole arena by making our arguments mystical rather than rational. And therefore, the whole rational argument is no longer relevant to why we do what we do. It's a longer discussion, but I thought it was a very interesting point. But coming back to the point here. Yeah, Susan, sorry.
You mentioned the Christians, but before you had mentioned the Muslims, have they just left the Muslims alone and they only went after the Jews? Or was there also a movement against the Muslims?
So they didn't have Muslims under Christian control. Meaning, in this period, it's constant war between the Christians and the Muslims. You don't see Muslims living in Christian lands.
So just because we lived there, if they could have, they probably would have, but they couldn't. Have gone after the Muslims as well.
Islam is not a force in Christian lands, and Christianity is not a force in Muslim lands during this entire period. So it's really the Jews who are under their control who are much more of a target. That's my understanding. So what you're seeing here is, number one, a revival of European learning. Number two, the church developing an approach of, we need to convince people philosophically, rationally, that Christianity is true. And number three, Peter's efforts in exposing the Talmud as something that he argued was foolish and misleading. All of these drive the church to say, we need to stop Jews from learning the Talmud. We need to stop Jews from learning rabbinic writings. This will make them more open to our debates and our speeches. This is going to enable us finally to convert to the Jews. So that's from a philosophical perspective. But there was more to it. It wasn't just about the philosophy. It was also about the mechanics. The church's work was frustrated to this point in time largely because, or at least in part because, but I think largely because, they were relying on governments to carry out the censorship. That doesn't necessarily work, because governments have other interests. It's not only about keeping the church happy. So you have some developments that take place in the 13th and 14th centuries which enable the church to move away from governments. They don't yet. We'll talk more about what the governments were involved with, but first I want to just present these two mechanical changes. First, in the 13th century, the church creates two new orders of monks, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And the Dominicans and the Franciscans were the ones who would carry out the church's tasks throughout Europe. They are itinerant. They travel from place to place. The Pope Innocent, in the year 1207, authorizes itinerant preachers. One of them was a fellow named Domingo de Guzman, or Dominic, who attracted other monks who became the Dominicans in the year 1214. And by 1221, just 7 years later, the Dominicans had 60 convents in 8 provinces. Spain, Provence, France, England, Germany, Hungary, Lombardy, and Romagnola. 60 convents in just 7 years. In that same period, Giovanni Bernardone Francesco, also known as St. Francis of Assisi, founds the order of the Franciscans. The Dominicans and the Franciscans become the arm of the church for censoring Jewish books. So I see a note in the chat. Marlene says there were no printed books at the time, so all books at the time would only have been available in monasteries and other places of learning. So it's true that you are pre-printing press. And it's certainly true that places of learning are going to be the ones that have the major access to books. However, we'll see, among Jews, you know, texts were widespread. Jewish homes tend to have Jewish texts. We'll talk more about that. But certainly among the Jews, you had a spread of literacy and an emphasis on literacy. But the Dominicans and the Franciscans are really important in enabling censorship. The other innovation is the establishment of the papal inquisition courts. I realize that I've been abandoning my source sheet. I shouldn't. Take a look at source number 7 from Michael Robson, The Franciscans in the Middle Ages. And I just put the link for the source sheet in the chat again. He's talking about, as you can see, the Franciscans. The friars' preparation for their ministry made them a dedicated and efficient body of men. While papal letters facilitated the geographical spread of the order, the popes looked to the order as a band of talented men capable of shouldering various missions. This was their weapon. But, in addition, again, we talk about not just the Franciscans and the Dominicans, but also the establishment of the Inquisition courts. Take a look at source number 8. Up to the time, this is from the Catholic Encyclopedia, up to the time of Gregory the Ninth, the duty of searching out heretics belonged to the bishops in their respective dioceses. The so-called monastic inquisition was established by Gregory the Ninth, who in his bulls of 1320 and 22nd of April 1233 appointed the Dominicans as the official inquisitors for all dioceses of France. The monks are going to be the ones to carry it out instead of relying on local authority. So stop working with secular courts, stop working through the establishment, and instead work with these monks. Yes. Go ahead.
I have a question.
Yes.
This Inquisition, I may be wrong, started in Spain against the Muslims before it got to the Jews?
So, I don't think so. Meaning, when they conquer Muslim lands in Spain, as part of that back and forth war that continues until the 15th century, they do root out Islam there. But the Inquisition initially is against heresy, which is within the church, meaning among Christians, as well as these Jews who are holding out. We were not the only focus of the Inquisition. The Margot, I see, echoes this here in the chat. It began with the Christian heretics. That's a bigger discussion in its own right. But the Inquisition, along with the Dominicans and the Franciscans, are the mechanical steps that give a framework in which censorship can actually take place. Censorship is hard. Even before the printing press, it was hard. Forget after the printing press. But it was always a challenge to try to carry this out. So what you needed was the philosophical reason for doing it and the means of doing it. In the 13th century, which you know we've already been talking about, in the 13th century, censorship was largely government-run. So the most famous example of censorship of Jewish books would have to be the debate and then burning of the Talmud in the year 1240 in France, memorialized in a kina, I guess you can call it a wailing, I hesitate to call it a prayer, that's recited on Tisha B'Av, the annual day of grief for the destruction of the temple and for other tragedies of Jewish history. There's a kina called Shalis Trufa Ba'esh, which is all about that. This was incredibly important. I'm going to take a look at source number 9 here and read to you from a paper by a fellow named Dr. Sadia Eisenberg called Reading Medieval Religious Disputation. It's source number 9 on the source sheet. I've seen a few names come through the waiting room, by the way, here, who I don't recognize as having signed up. So really, I'd like you to be able to get the source sheets in advance and get the links for the recording afterwards. So please make sure either send me your email address in the chat or email me, but I want to make sure that people are able to register. So, looking at the beginning of source number 9, the 1240 debate represented a turning point in the history of the relations between Ashkenazi Jewry and Latin Christendom. An impressive event attended by an imposing array of dignitaries, this debate offered an opportunity for broad public display of new argumentation. I realize I didn't properly introduce the debate, so let me pause for a second. I shouldn't have launched right into this. Here's the story behind it, and then we'll read more of Eisenberg's piece. In the year 1236, there was a fellow by the name of Nicholas Donin. He was a Jew who had converted to Christianity. He went to Pope Gregory the Ninth, and he presented 35 different arguments against the Talmud on his own. He claimed that the Talmud distorted biblical verses. He claimed that it taught unworthy conceptions of God. He claimed that it valued rabbinic writing over the biblical text. He claimed that it had abusive language about Christianity. Now, to be clear, some of these claims are very clearly understandable when you've studied Talmud. So, for example, the Talmud talks about how rabbinic legislation is beloved to the Jewish people because it is our human contribution to Torah. And in that sense, it is even more valued than the divine legislation. So there's a volume of the Talmud called Yevamot, which lists a whole bunch of prohibited relationships. And first it lists the ones that are rabbinically prohibited, and then the ones that are biblically prohibited, because it represents our human contribution to Torah. So he's not wrong in saying that the Talmud values the rabbinic and human contribution. It is certainly true that the rabbinic ear, when it analyzes biblical text, notes nuances of language and presents homiletic ideas based on those nuances of language that you could look at and say, see, what they're teaching is different from the biblical text. They're warping the biblical text. I understand why somebody can say it, but he uses that as a basis to attack rabbinic writing to Pope Gregory. So Gregory instructs the secular and religious rulers of France, England, Castile, Aragon, and Portugal to confiscate volumes of the Talmud, not all volumes, but to take volumes of the Talmud and give them to the local Franciscans and Dominicans to be examined on the first Saturday of Lent. Of course, he picks a Saturday. Spain and England ignored it. We're not interested. France, home of the authors of the Tosfot commentary to the Talmud, leading teachers of Torah in that day, you could argue that France was at that point the center of Jewish scholarship of that time. France followed it, with a death penalty for Jews who would not cooperate in turning over volumes of the Talmud. The Jews tried to get this process delayed. The way you try to get processes like this delayed is how? What do you do? What, Susan?
Procrastinate.
No. You got to be better than that. Yeah, you bribe them. You try to pay the officials so that they're not going to carry this out. But ultimately, they lose. And it comes down to a debate between Nicholas Donin and four rabbis in Paris on June 24th in the year 1240. The most famous of the rabbis involved, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, was one of the leading Jewish authorities of the day. The rabbis did not succeed in convincing the commission. Of course, the commission was from the church. They did not succeed in convincing the commission that the Talmud was innocent of these charges. And the result was that they burned the Talmud, and we'll talk about just how much shortly, in the Place de Grève, just north of the Church of Notre Dame. That's why, if you remember, when the church burned last year, there were many Jews who said, "We don't feel bad." They lost their church. Sorry?
When you have these kind of debates, were they like current wrestling or boxing matches that you knew who better win?
So I'm going to talk about that in a moment. It's a very good question. Mark asks what exactly this debate would have looked like, and how fair would this debate have been. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But it was hard to feel bad for the burning of the church, which is right across the street from where they burned the Talmud. It was just north of the church. Take a look at source number 9 now. Now that I gave you that background,
you're breaking up again.
My computer. Let's see if I can work on the speaker for a second. Better?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I have a backup plan if need be. I just prefer not to use it. It would be working off of my phone instead. Okay. You know, maybe I'm going to set up my phone to get on the Zoom, and that way I'll have it as a as an option if this goes out again. But take a look. Yeah, there it goes. Okay, take a look at source number 9. The 1240 debate represented a turning point in the history of the relations between Ashkenazi Jewry and Latin Christendom. An impressive event attended by an imposing array of dignitaries, this debate offered an opportunity for broad public display of new argumentation. While Donin's specific argumentation, Donin being Nicholas Donin, who attacked the Jews in the first place, does not seem to have served as a model for other formal debates. Pablo Cristiani, the Christian protagonist in the disputations in Barcelona in 1263 and in Paris in 1270, and we'll talk about him, did not follow Donin's line of argumentation. The very assertion that the church had the right to confiscate, examine, and destroy Jewish literature, specifically the Talmud, set a new tone for Christian-Jewish relationships in centuries to come. The clerical court found the Talmud guilty as charged and condemned it to flames. The Jews managed to forestall implementation of the sentence, but after a number of delaying machinations, 20 or 24 different accounts, wagon loads of Talmudic manuscripts, probably 10 to 12,000 volumes, and remember, this is before the printing press, were burned in Paris in the Place de Grève, the execution site which symbolized medieval French justice, over the course of 1.5 days in 1242. The loss of books and resulting disruption of study among Jews contributed to the decline of the Jewish schools in northern France. Equally demoralizing for northern French Jewry was the vision of the Talmud, a symbol of Jewish history, accomplishment, tradition, values, and religion, going up in flames. From a long-range point of view, Jews in Christian lands were now put in the position of having to respond to challenges to Talmudic law, ideology, and literature proffered by antagonistic Christians, challenges which continued into the modern era. It put all Jews on notice that you are going to have to defend your Judaism to them. So Mark asked an interesting question. What kind of debate is this anyway? is this fixed, where the conclusion is already foregone? So the answer, I think, based on what I've read, is that it really depends on the individual disputation and who the authority was. In some cases, the authorities involved actually said, no, we're going to do a fair judgment. We're going to be impartial. You can't be impartial because the charges are being brought, you know, already against the Jews. It's not as though the judges who are the ones who are setting this up have not heard the charges and have not supported them. Nonetheless, they said, if you can defend, if you can show that there's nothing here that's hostile to Christianity, if you can show that there's nothing here that places rabbinic writing over biblical and so on, then we're not going to censor your work. Yes, please.
While this is going on in the Christian land, what was going on in the Middle East and the Muslim lands about the Jewish books?
Right. So that's a really good question, but it's beyond the scope of where we're going to get to. The status of Jews in Muslim lands is fascinating at this point. There is a major conflict among the historians between those who argue for convivencia, who say that the Jews were actually doing very well in Muslim lands, that there was a lot of joint study and that kind of thing, and those who argue that actually convivencia is a myth, largely invented by modern historians who want to propose the idea that there was a time of peace between them. And when you look at things like the Pact of Omar, and when you look at what we discussed last year when we talked about the Almohads, you find a different story. But it's really beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. So this demolition of Jewish scholarship in France results in a seismic shift in the Jewish community. France became a major center of Jewish learning in the 11th century. Rashi was born in Troyes, in France. He went to Germany, which had been the center of Jewish scholarship, and studied there. And then he went back to France and established his own study center there. And people came to that center in order to learn from Rashi. And then when Rashi's descendants, first and second generation, became the authors of the classic Tosfot commentary to the Talmud, became leaders of Jewish communities, the result was that France became the major center of Jewish scholarship. But this dynamites it. This completely destroys it. The center shifts back to Germany, really until the 14th century. In the 14th century, German persecution drives the Jews to leave Germany, either to go to the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, or to go to Poland, which we talked about last year when we talked about King Casimir. I also wonder if there weren't Jews who left France at this point already to go east to Poland, because we find in 1264 that King Boleslav the Pious of Poland gave Jews freedom of worship, trade, and travel in the Statute of Kalish. So I wonder if there weren't Jews who already migrated through France all the way east at this point. But that's one debate. And one incredibly tragic disaster that results. Was that debate rigged? Was it a fair debate? I don't know enough about the contents of that debate. What we know much more about is the debate in 1263 we've already alluded to. In 1263, the Dominicans pressed King James of Aragon to do the same thing that was done in France. That he should hold a debate, a burning of the Talmud, forced conversion of the Jews, and it all hinges on... What's wrong, Susan? It all hinges on...
Where did you say this was?
This is in Aragon, a province which later becomes Spain.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, there's a Dominican convert by the name of Pablo Cristiani, and he is the one who instigates debate against Ramban, Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, also known as Nachmanides, in July of 1263. Nachmanides is actually close with King James. And he says, I don't want any part of this. There's no way to win. Mark asked the question of, were these debates fixed? He says, look, either I win and I'm going to get persecuted, or I lose and we're going to get persecuted. There's no percentage in me engaging in this debate. And he gets a promise of protection. that whatever happens in this debate, whatever he says, if he wins the debate, he'll be fine. And on that basis, he engages in the debate. He wins the debate. We have Nachmanides' record of what actually happened in this debate, and it's fascinating. There was actually a movie made of it also. There's a movie called The Disputation that was made about this story. I can't advocate for the movie, but I can tell you that someone made a movie out of it. Yeah. So, like, one of the key parts of the debate is where he is called upon to explain passages in Judaism that the church claims support Christianity. Example, there's a rabbinic teaching that says that the Messiah was born on the day that the temple was destroyed. So the church argued that's a prediction of their Savior. To which Nachmanides points out that, first of all, the temple is destroyed in the year 68 or 70 of the Common Era. So it's a little late for that to be when their Savior was born. Their Savior had already passed away by then. That's number one. Number two, that's an idea which is meant to teach lessons about destruction and redemption, and how the seeds of redemption are there even at the time that the destruction takes place. It wasn't meant as a historical statement about when the Messiah is physically born. And he goes on in that vein. It's a fascinating discussion, and like I said, you can get the narrative that Nachmanides published. The problem was that after winning, he published his record of the debate. The church didn't like that. They weren't so good with that idea that he would publish his record. And so, in August of 1263, the Pope orders that the Jews should submit to their work, not for burning, but for what's called expurgation. We're going to talk about expurgation, but this is a form of modifying the books to remove the elements that the church finds offensive. The Jews did not cooperate. There was a new decree from the Pope in 1264. James repealed it. There was a new edict in 1265. James repealed that as well. In 1266, the Pope censures James, and he threatens him with excommunication if he won't comply. And at that point, James of Aragon caves in and confiscates the texts for examination. Nachmanides is forced out of Spain at that point, and he ends up going to Israel. But interestingly, this doesn't keep the Jews from publishing. In fields as diverse as biblical commentary, Talmudic study, responsa, mysticism, the Jews of this era, in these lands, continue to generate text prolifically. They just keep on going.
Is this all handwritten?
Yes, it's all handwritten. All handwritten. That brings us to the second period of this. That was your first period, okay? You're talking really the 13th century, predominantly, a little bit at the end of the 12th. So your second period, 14th century, most of the 15th century, censorship's a failure, despite the Dominicans and Franciscans and the Inquisition. The communities recognize that they need the Jews. The Christians and the Muslims are not trading with each other. They're not lending money to each other. And Jews are needed to fill the role. And therefore, local authorities are not interested in carrying these things out. And the Dominicans and the Franciscans don't have weapons. They don't have armies. There's a limit to what they can do. The Jews did particularly well in Italy because they fled there from their problems in France and then in Spain. But then you get this third period that begins in the late 15th century and lasts into modern times. And it is spurred by the creation of the printing press, Gutenberg. Right? Take a look at source number 10, please. Gutenberg's legacy. The Catholic Church quickly realized the potential of the printing press as a challenge to its influence. Censorship was introduced into the print shop in 1487 when Pope Innocent VIII required that church authorities approve all books before publication. The church had censored books for centuries, though it became much more difficult to do so after the invention of printing. Controlling a dozen painfully copied manuscripts of a forbidden text may have been a manageable task, but controlling thousands of copies churning off the presses every year was quite another matter. One of these forbidden texts was the Bible, printed in any other language than Latin. Right, because they wanted to understand what was being produced. So in the 1470s, the church declares control of publication. All publication is now under the authority of the Inquisition. One interesting result was that the Jewish-run printing presses, because there were some, engaged in self-censorship. We're going to come back to that later, wanting to avoid having the church come in on them. In 1547, there's a ban on Jewish-run printing in Italian provinces that lasts until 1810. Till 1810, you couldn't have a Jew running a printing press, other than this one edition of Psalms that got printed. In the 1550s, the Dominicans led a hunt, led by Cardinal Carlo Carafa, who would later become Paul IV. And the campaign is to burn the Talmud and other Jewish books in Italy. You know what spurred that? A Franciscan monk who converted to Judaism. So at that point they said, we need a renewed campaign. In 1595, the Bishop of Mantua establishes a three-person commission to review Jewish books that had already been published and censor them. And Jews were required to bring their books for censorship. And that grew and spread in communities in the Italian provinces. So the church, because of the invention of the printing press, becomes a lot more active. You also find a trend moving away from let's get rid of books that have already been printed into instead what I mentioned before, pre-publication censorship. Part of the reason for that is just it's really hard to get rid of books that have already been printed. But part of it is also because there's a lot of tension developing in this period. Europe is becoming more liberal. Leading authorities and thinkers are less accommodating of the idea that you should be hunting down and burning books. So the church says, well, if we can get them not to print them in the first place, that makes our job a lot easier. I've already mentioned two Jews who converted to Christianity who helped this thing along, right? Nicholas Donin and Pablo Cristiani. I'm going to mention another one now, and I put his name in source number 11. His name is Joseph Johann Pfefferkorn. He was a Jew who converted to Christianity and became a Dominican monk. And he published a work called Das Judenspiegel. It was meant to be the first in a series of attacks on the Talmud. His campaign was to try to get the German king named Maximilian to authorize Pfefferkorn to examine all Jewish-owned books and destroy anything against the Bible, anything against Christianity. The Jews protested. Friendly Christians protested. And the Archbishop of, I'm going to mispronounce this city's name because I forgot to look it up in advance, Gemmingen is the way I'm pronouncing it, which is probably wrong. Any German speakers want to correct me? G-E-M-I-N-G-E-N? All right, I'm going to go with Gemmingen then. But the Archbishop, a fellow by the name of Uriel, actually declared the decree of Maximilian, the decree against Jewish-owned books, illegal. So Pfefferkorn is not done. He says, you know what I need? I need legitimacy. So I want to get a scholar to work with me. He will study the Hebrew texts. He will confirm my allegations. And now the church, this fellow Archbishop Uriel, will have no choice but to support me. And he gets a German philosopher by the name of Johann Reuchlin. I put his name in source number 11 as well. And he gets Reuchlin to work with him. Now, Reuchlin had learned Hebrew from a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Ovadia of Sforno. You may be familiar, some of you may be familiar, he wrote a commentary to the biblical text Sforno. So he taught Reuchlin Hebrew. I see your hand, Ian, one moment. Reuchlin works with Pfefferkorn and decides Pfefferkorn's charges are false. So Pfefferkorn's move backfired. He wanted to get academic legitimacy, and the academic he hired actually said, no, what you're doing is illegitimate. Yes, Ian?
In time in Europe, France, Spain, wherever, England, if a bookseller was distributing or selling books that were illegal, it was punishable by death.
So it depends on where, and it depends on when. There were times when that was true, but we're dealing here with a period when a lot of the orders are starting up and they're still controversial, and not everybody is on board. So there's a whole back and forth, which I'm going to condense a little bit, in which Pfefferkorn keeps on pushing ahead. Reuchlin is opposing. The University of Heidelberg is called into this, and they decide on behalf of the Jews. Reuchlin ends up being investigated by the church and condemned. The whole thing goes back and forth, and it ends up going back to Rome itself, where Pope Leo X orders all the previous verdicts set aside and says, Reuchlin, I want you to defend yourself before the Inquisition. But the inquisitor, who's supposed to try him, doesn't show up. And so Reuchlin is acquitted. The whole thing goes around and around until, in 1520, the Pope decrees that all Jewish works will have to be censored before publication, that pre-publication censorship that we mentioned. There's a similar battle that goes on in the 1550s in the province of Cremona. The result of all of this back and forth, and the frustration that the church is experiencing in trying to carry this out, leads to the publication of what you see in number 12 on your sheet, the Index Librorum Prohibitorum. I'm missing an R. Librorum Prohibitorum. This is the Index of Prohibited Books, published in 1559 by Pope Paul IV. Interestingly, and I see it's 10:58, so we're going to just finish up a couple of notes. The church. Sorry.
Where's the book? I'm looking. I can't find it.
Source number 12 on your source sheet. Thank you.
It doesn't say any name. It says any place that mentions that God is saved is lost.
I'm not sure what you're looking at.
Oh no! This is what I got for source 12.
Does anybody else have this in source 12? Yes. No. I've got yeses, and I've got noes.
I've got the index.
Okay, I'm sending it out afterwards, and we'll be okay that way. Everyone will see it then. I don't know why. I must have made a mistake in something.
My 11 and 12 are totally different than what you're saying.
That's funny. Okay, I must have made a mistake somewhere, but I want to get through a couple of things here.
So that's on the wrong page. She's on the next page.
She's on the next page. Okay, no, the answer is that I must have done something wrong at some point, but I really want to make sure to finish where we are right now. So that's what we're going to do. So the index is published by Pope Paul IV in the year 1559. He generally avoids listing Hebrew books in the index because he doesn't want to give them honor by doing so. At the same time, he wants to get rid of Jewish books. So what you end up with is a work that is a work in progress. It gets expanded over time from its original list. The other thing that you see happen is that they employ what I talked about before. They employ expurgation. Expurgation means we're going to get rid of offensive passages from books, passages that anthropomorphize God, passages that teach what the church calls bad morals. They try to substitute within texts. So, for example, they don't like the word Talmud. They censor the word Talmud, and instead it has to be called Gemara. Because the Talmud is bad, so the word Talmud has to disappear. You know what? I'm not going to rush through this, because rushing through it is a mistake. So what I'm going to do is pick up with that I think next time, and we have some discussions still that we have to do on censorship before we move to the second topic, but that's okay. But take a look on your sheet. Hopefully those who have the right sheet will see review questions, which I gave to try to help people to remember, because we're dealing with a lot of historical information here, and I'm gonna go through them next time also to make sure that we got what we were trying to get, what we were trying to get to. But yes, I'm gonna send out the source sheet later when I do the follow-up email, and we can continue the conversation at that point. So thank you very much. I'll stick around for a few minutes for questions and discussion, but anybody who has to go should please feel free.
Just let me apologize. You have 212s, and the trouble was I was on the second 12.
I have 212s?
On page number three, you have 11, 12, 13.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at the wrong 12. On the second page, you have 12 also.
Really?
After the questions. Look at the page after the questions.
Oh, because it's within source 14.
Right, I didn't realize.
Got it. Okay. Problem solved. I'm glad.
Since I did not register, I don't know with all these lectures. Can you mail me the handout?
I'm not sure. I thought you had registered. I'll check, and you'll be on the. I will put you on it, and therefore you'll get it when I do the follow up email.
Okay.
But I thought you were on it already. That's odd.
Pardon me?
I thought you were on it already. That's strange.
Yes, but I did not. I don't know how to find it.
Yeah, it might have gone to your spam.